This is Philosophy Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Simon Phipps and I talk with Matthias Kirschner of the Free Software Foundation Europe, a really outstanding organization, very different from any other in the world, very effective, and about a new book that he's coming out with, or already is out in parts of the world and in some languages, Ada and Zangemann. It is a really great book. It's a really great show, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 708, recorded Wednesday, November 23rd, 2022. Europe flies the Floss flag. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat that lets you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process and what they've learned from their experiences. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. Hello, good morning, good evening, whenever it is, wherever you are. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. And this week I'm joined by Simon Phipps himself. We can almost make an Earth sandwich because we are, I think, 10 or 12 hours apart.
We're opposite sides of the globe. Doc is in some beautiful warm place with tropical birds outside the window. And I'm sitting here in the dark trying to work out whether I want to start the fan heater or not.
And somebody is outside right now dragging a pallet, a skid. So you can hear some of the noise in the background. This is Hawaii, as you can tell from my shirt. And I'm here for just this week. Next week I'll be back on what they call the mainland here. So our guest today, Matthias Kirschner, you brought him in, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
It's all my fault. Matthias runs Free Software Foundation Europe, which is the free software's head body in Europe, and it's quite different from the FSFE from the FSF that you might be used to in North America. A much younger age profile, quite a different approach to advocacy. And the thing that's really fascinating is Matthias just wrote a children's book as a way of explaining what software freedom was to kids.
It's
and
wonderful. So I read it. Yeah.
Just before Christmas, you know, everyone's out buying holiday gifts at the moment. His book is about to become available. We're a show. We ought to have people promoting books on this show. So yeah. Here is a really interesting guy who's written a really interesting book, and he's on the show.
So let's get to it. We're off to a bit of a late start for the usual technical reasons. So Matthias Kirschner, he'll go by Matthias or Matthias, depending on which one of us is talking here, is the president of FSFE, the Free Software Foundation Europe. He helps other organizations, companies, and public administrators understand how they can benefit from free software, which is most of our listeners and viewers know is grants everyone the rights to use, study, share, and improve software, and how those rights help support freedom of speech, press, and privacy. He serves on the advisory boards, that's plural, of different free software organizations. He's been a consultant to public bodies and other committees, and regularly gives interviews, lectures, and participates in stuff like this for better distribution of power in a democratic society. Welcome to the show, Matthias.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
So Matthias, I've read your book, and just this morning, as a matter of fact. And I'm wondering what got you going. I know we got Ada going, your fictional child there in the book. But what got you going?
To write the book or in general about free software?
Well, we could cover the book later. But I mean, what is the path by which you arrived at your advocacy of free software?
I mean, the beginning was that I was... first of all, I got into computers from my father, where I also played around with them and programmed a little bit with them, like some basic programming. And then later... I tried to convince my father that we should subscribe more newspapers so I can inform myself from different sources. And my father said, oh, that's going to be too expensive. But I read something about the internet and I'll get you a modem, and then you can inform yourself from different areas of the world. And yeah, he got the modem, and I think in the end it was more expensive, but well, and so I was one of the first ones in the school with internet connection at home, which was for me really great to see what is going on out there and what so many people are contributing. And then later I had a second computer at home, and I connected the two of them, and I wanted to send an email from one of the computers to the other computer. And both of them had email programs installed, but I somehow was not able to achieve it, to send one email to the other without connecting to the internet with the modem, which was still expensive. I complained about that in school, and then someone told me, oh, I have something for you. And a day later, I had a few CDs and floppies, and that was my first GNU Linux distribution. And from there, it started that I installed this, fall in love with the command line, because I didn't get X running for quite a while in the beginning. And yes, then over the time, I then like was setting up Linux user groups. I met with others. We had installation parties, went to free software events. And then I discovered that all of that is also quite political. And that's how I then got started, that I read articles on the GNU pages, some other writings out there. And that's when I then realized, wow, it's not just a technical issue. It's actually also an issue which is very important for society, for our democracy. And also, I couldn't say it at that time, but I mean, for me, it's now in a democracy, we are distributing power, and it's important that not that there is no single point with a lot of power. And I believe that free software is a very important component for a technical distribution of power, and thereby a very important stone in the foundation for a working democracy.
Right. Now, you're the president of Free Software Foundation Europe. I think you're maybe the third president that Free Software Foundation Europe has had.
Yes.
Tell me about the relationship between Free Software Foundation Europe and the Free Software Foundation that many of the American listeners and viewers are familiar with.
So the Free Software Foundation was founded in 1985 by Richard Stallman, with also the aim to create a free operating system and promote free software, where all the components are it's allowed to use, study, share, and improve them. And in 2001, the Free Software Foundation Europe was founded with the same goals: to promote free software, to encourage the development of free software, and to campaign for free software, but with the context of a European organization. So the idea was to set up a network of free software foundations throughout the world, where each of those organizations, financially and personally independent of each other, follow the same goals, but keep in mind where they are coming from. So for our side, finding a European approach to promote free software and reach people in Europe about this.
Right. And you've got some fairly distinctive campaigns that you're running in Europe. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about those campaigns, particularly the shirt you're wearing has got one of them on. Tell us about the approaches that you're taking to advocacy, because you're typically not tub thumping about how you've got to say free and not open source, and you're typically doing positive things that are campaigning for positive change. Tell us.
Yeah, so there is, with the shirt, it's public money, public code. That's a campaign framework we started by the FSFE, and then got a lot of other organizations involved in this. The idea there is that we want that publicly financed software should be published under free software license. And what we did about that was we were setting up a website with arguments about that, with a video, with an open letter that you can sign when you support this this demand. And we created a brochure. We translated all of those things in different languages. So you find all of that under publiccode.eu with all the materials there. that's actually now the website on fsfe.org. But when you follow, then it's the public code .eu website. And what we are doing there as well is then we are reaching out to politicians for before elections, asking them about the positions there. We answer questions by politicians and public administrations. We bring people from public administrations who want to promote free software, who want to use it in their infrastructure, together in contact with other people who work in a different public administration in another country in Europe, so that they can share experience, best practices, and maybe also come together to do joint projects there. So that's one larger campaign we are running for a long time, because we think that when taxpayers' money is used to create software, the whole society should benefit from that. Other public administrations should benefit from it, companies should be able to benefit from it, and individuals should be able to benefit from it.
Right. I particularly love that campaign, Matas, because you know, by talking about public money and public code, using the word public instead of free or open, we're all able to join in and campaign on that subject. It's very inclusive, and there's a big circle of organizations and individuals in Europe who are all able to join in with that. Was that intentional on your part, to try and make sure that it could use it a language that could have a wider community working on it?
I mean, the main idea was, before we worked on many different aspects on, like, we were following migrations to proprietary software or to free software, like the Linux project in Munich, some other public administrations who used free software and then not used free software anymore. And the idea was, how do we find, how can we phrase the idea of the importance of free software for public administrations in a way that it's easy to understand, easy to grasp. And like, if you first have to explain what is free software, what is open source software, you might lose a few valuable time to convince people. And we thought that when it's public money, public code, that public code is a good synonym there for free software or open source software, and that many people are then able to, as you said, join in there and contribute and use this campaign framework in their own work. And that's also, I think, one of the big advantages there, as you said, that meanwhile there are so many organizations out there who use slides about public money, public code, who show the video, who use this when when promoting their work towards public administrations or the public. So the idea there was really to make it possible for many organizations and individuals to join and reuse materials. Yes.
Right, right. Now, yesterday you started another campaign about the freedom to use software on any device. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's coming from, I mean, we are already working in this area for a longer time. It's we have a campaign called upcyclingandroid.org. And there, the idea is to explain people how about sustainability and software, and to encourage them to think about how long to use certain devices, in this case a mobile phone, and how much we could save as humankind in electronic waste if we would just be able to use our phones 1 year or 2 years longer. And that's a project which is financed by the German Agency for Environmental Protection. And we are doing workshops there to show people how to install alternative ROMs on their phones, be it and other Android ROMs or also post-market OS or other GNU Linux systems. And we help them bring devices there so that they can hack and test it out, and also lose a little bit the fear of flashing another operating system on your device. And from this campaign, what we now started there was we already had an open letter for a while, open for signatures by organizations, but there were so many people who said that they would also like to sign that as individuals, that we now brought this up for individual donors as well. So the idea there is that you should have the universal right to install any software on any device, or also remove any software from any device, so that you have more control over your own devices, that you are able to choose between different service providers to connect your device to, that you are able, for example, to exchange the App Store or the browser, or the services like the speech recognition or whatsoever, and that that those devices are then interoperable and compatible with open standards, and that for your devices you also get the code for drivers, tools, interfaces, that they are all published under a free software license.
Right, right.
So that's the demand there. Long way ahead of us, but it's a start.
So we could talk about several of the campaigns. You've got your Route of Freedom campaign to help people be able to connect to the internet without having to be intermediated by their ISP. You've also got a member of staff who works on European policy. How is all this funded, Matthias? Because you've got, you know, I was at SFSCon with you last week. You had like 18 people with you. How are you funding all this?
I mean, from the 18 people you met there, part of them were volunteers. Some of them are also then staffers, but they are part-time. So, but yes, we finance ourselves, first of all, through donations. So over one third of our income is through donations by sustaining members, our supporters. So they are individuals who are donating to us for our work. Then there are companies who are donating to us. And then the other part are then some project funding, like now with Upcycling Android from the German Agency for Environmental Protection. Or we are also participating in EU projects, Horizon Europe, where we are part of a consortium when people apply and do free software projects and which are funded by the European Commission, then we help them with legal questions around free software licensing issues and help them to make sure that in the end the public money which is spent there is actually also public code free software. And so that's another part of the funding, plus then some funding through sponsorships for events, which is a smaller part there. You can find out all about our finances and the sponsors when you go on our website under About and then Transparency Commitment, where you can see all the income, the cash flow, and our donors. That's all listed there.
And just had up the legal support page, which I think is quite a significant part of what you do, because you know, you're not just an advocacy organization. You've also created a reuse framework to help people to get the licensing information right on code that you're working with. You run a big international network of legal experts that's got everybody's general counsel on, so that we can raise legal issues between organizations and between companies. How big a part of your work is your legal activity? Are you kind of 50-50 for civil society and legal, or are you much more about legal issues as an organization, would you say?
I mean, the three areas are public awareness, so general informing the public about free software. The other one is policy, and then there is legal. And the distribution between those three areas, it's changing from time to time. So depending on what campaigns what activities we have at the moment, which are more pressing there. I mean, at the moment in the legal part, we have one full-time position, one and a half full-time positions for a lot of the legal work, plus some hours for the reuse. I would say another like 30% for reuse, 30% of a full-time employee. So in total, almost two full-time positions are on our legal side. But to understand that, I mean, the FSFE is also, as an organization, heavily run by volunteers. So we have the staff, but they are there, and we need them for a lot of things where it's sometimes more difficult to involve volunteers. For example, if it pops up, oh, next week there is an important debate, an important meeting in Brussels in the commission, we need to send someone there to represent us, then that's something which is very difficult for a volunteer to, in this short time frame, then to prepare for the meeting, go there and represent the interests of software freedom there. But beside that, there are many, many volunteers who coordinate activities, who do translations. They run the activities in the different European countries. They take care about website, about the development of new tools. Like we participated in a competition by the European Commission about public procurement data. And one of our volunteers, together with a working student at that time, started a project called Detective, where you can you can find out, for example, how much money, how many tenders did Microsoft Germany GmbH get from public administrations, for what. You can find out who was involved on those tenders. And we built a prototype for that, and in the end, actually, even won the first award in this category for more transparency in public procurement. And it wouldn't have been possible without the help of volunteers, again, who were starting all of that. So
I have a couple additional questions, one of which involves funding and activism in general, and kind of going further in that. But first, I have to let people know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat. You know, when you're working on a project and you leave behind a small reminder in the code, a code comment to help others learn from your work, this podcast takes that idea by letting you listen in on two experienced technologists as they describe their building process. There's a lot of work required to bring a project from whiteboard to development, and none of us could do it alone. The host, Burr Sutter, is a Red Hatter and a lifelong developer advocate and a community organizer. In each episode, Burr sits down with experienced technologists from across the industry to trade stories and to talk about what they've learned from their experiences. And I've listened to some of these. I subscribe. It's really good. There's one I just listened to on the subject of networking and the history of networks, where networks are going. I recommend that. All episodes are available anywhere you listen to podcasts and at redhat.com/codecommentspodcast, all one word, Code Comments Podcast. Search for Code Comments in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to Code Comments for their support. So, Matthias, I was looking at the About page you were mentioning earlier. There's a roster of pretty much every name brand, you might say, advocacy group there. It's also great seeing Greg Crow Hartman's face there as one of your members and supporters. He was on the show last week, and it was great. I recommend checking that out. He's awesome. And no corporate sponsors. And is that a bylaw that you have no corporate sponsors, or is that a choice at your end at the FSFE? I'm wondering how that works. And none is a good answer. I run a nonprofit that doesn't allow corporate contributions, so I know what that's about.
I'm not sure which page you then ended up.
At the FSFE, I don't know which one. Anyway. Go ahead, we're talking over each other. Latency at work.
Yes. So if you go to the About page and in the transparency commitment, you see like about our finances, and there you also see our donors. And there are other pages there about our associated organizations. Like when you go to donations, or maybe the shorter one is go back, go to donations. Sorry. This is also an important page.
Our producer is now.
Who donates to us? Under donations, there is who donates to us. Yes, and there you see the donors there.
Okay, this,
and there you
okay,
also great. See we have corporate donors as well. And so that's not something that we don't accept. So as I mentioned before, over one third of our income is through our supporters, and then the other parts is a large part then about the donations by companies who are also supporting our work there.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering. I mean, I don't say there's a sort of principle that says that, you know, follow the money and you find out where the influence is. How do you deal with that? Because you got Huawei and you have Google on that page. Mm. And those two in particular, for different reasons, are often accused of having corporate influence. And I'm wondering how you either get around that or just ignore it. It seems to be your principles are so strong that ignoring is not a hard thing to do. Tell us a little about that.
I mean, with every donation, you are influenced. So that's clear. What we try to do is we are aware about this, that when companies are donating to you or also large individuals are donating to you, that this can have an influence on our work. So the first thing we do about that is we have exactly that page so that everyone out there can have a look where our money is coming from. And we encourage everyone who has a look at that and also our activities and thinks that we are doing something in a way because we might have received money from one of those companies, or we are not doing certain things because we have received money from one of those companies, that everyone out there can help us to raise those questions so that we can then reflect on them on our own again. So that's very important for me, because I think in organizations, you often, when you just think about it on your own, you might somehow justify some things. And for the FSV, it's important that there are outside triggers for discussions, even if that sometimes might feel for the organization itself like some people spinning up some conspiracy theories. But it's still a very important trigger there, that you then have to think about that. Was that really something that had an influence? Might we be influenced too much about this? So those are very important discussions we regularly have. The other thing that we have is we have a financial reserve, which is bigger than any of the donations we have, we receive from the companies. So if any of the donors will stop funding us, we still have enough money there that this will not be immediately a problem for us, but that we have several months to compensate and find other solutions for the loss of the money there. And the other part is that our aim is always to gather the money which we need the next year already by the end of the year before. So we are now at the moment finding the money for our budget next year, and then we can operate quite independently of additional income there. So that's always our goal. And the other thing is that we have several very principled people in the organization who always make clear towards donors that a donation is a donation. That means that, yes, we will list you on this website, also for transparency reasons, but that there is nothing you get in return beside this. We mention people, but you will not be allowed to participate in strategy meetings or other meetings in a different way than anyone else out there. So if we are discussing a new topic, we will find out the stakeholders there, but there is no preference of donors towards other organizations out there who will have a good input there. And from time to time, there are then also situations where you have to tell people that, that they are asking for something in return. And, in those cases, we also explain them that, that's not how it's going to work at the FSFE. For example, recently we had an event, and there was One of the sponsors of the event contacted us and said, oh yeah, we are sponsoring the event. The call for papers is already over. Would it still be possible to have a speaking slot there? And our reply then was, well, if you wouldn't be a sponsor, it wouldn't be a problem at all. We could just accept you. But because you are a sponsor, we now have to call a talk with the jury about that, if we can allow you to still submit something there. So, and by doing this and, repeatedly clarifying that, for the FSFE, one of the most important values is to be neutral from company interests. This is something that we constantly work on to make sure that we can act in a way that we think is best for software freedom and not what some companies might think is good for their own for software freedom.
That's a more than complete answer, and I thank you for that. I want to say, add to what Simon already said about your advocacy of free software being, and I hate to say this because I love the FSF here in the U.S., but one reason open source became a thing was because it was really hard to explain free software. I think making the public money, public code, is so interesting because I mean, I think you're doing an awesome job of branding free software. I mean, it didn't happen in the U.S. I don't think it happened elsewhere very well, which is why open source became a thing. But I like, public doesn't have to mean, in the U.S., there's this notion that there's a public sector and a private sector, and the public sector is government. And it's not in your case. It's the idea is the public is the public, and the public is people, and the free software is for people, and it's for everything people do, including making stuff and making stuff work and keep working. And that just strikes me as an extraordinarily appealing thing. And I love the way that you're addressing kids and young people. And for the most part, it seems like your constituency is young as well, where, as Simon joked earlier, we tend to be graybeards over here. And I'm wondering, do you see this becoming a part of the general young people's movement that I think there's kind of worldwide agreement right now is the best hope for the world, as with our economies, especially with the environment and other things like that. Do you sort of see it that way? I mean, here it feels like an old people's movement. I hate to say that, but it does. Mm-hmm. It's free software. But do you see it as primarily a young people's thing? I'm projecting that because I want it to be that. But
so now I'm not 100% sure about that. So in Europe, we have the same problem that to find new people contributing to free software projects. Find new people who get active in organizations who promote software freedom out there. And so that's something where I think in general, we have those challenges to encourage young people to get active there. But I think that that is something that, I mean, for quite a while, people argued, the younger people, they are not political and they don't want to get active. I think with Fridays for Future and other movements we recently saw that they proved this wrong. So they want to shape their future, and they want to have an active role in society, not just a passive role. And in order in nowadays society to shape your future, you need to shape technology. Technology is shaping so many areas in our society, so you need to be able to understand how this environment works. You need to be able to make modifications to that, to adopt it to fit your goals. And that's why I think that a lot of the younger people who want to shape the future and take an active role in society, that they are a very good group of people whom you can encourage to also get active and in free software, to understand those tools, to influence those as well. And I mean, that's one thing which I think still needs a lot of work. to reach those younger generations. We we just had the last month's coding competition, Youth Hacking for Freedom, where we had 14 till 18 year olds competing with free software projects, who then afterwards were invited to an award ceremony and had and got some prize money for their own projects in the future. And that was something for me which was like, I just thought, wow, what they are doing there. And when you talk with them about what that they want to do good for society and what their ideas are, that was so motivating for me and so encouraging to continue with this and explaining them, helping them to understand how free software can help them to follow their ideas, to shape the future without a dependency on gray beards. And that's also one of the reasons with the children's book I think it's important to reach people at a very early age and explain them the advantages of free software and get them interested in technology, to tinker with technology, to self-determined use technology, and thereby, as I said, be able to have an active role in society.
Right. So, you know, that's a great segue into thinking about the book that you've written. I've had a read of your book. I unfortunately don't have any children the right age to read it to. My children are all about your age. My grandchildren are still too young to really enjoy the finer points of it, although they will listen to it being read to them. What made you write the book? You know, what was your motivation for writing it? Were you telling stories to a child, or you know, where did it come from?
So at the beginning, I thought, how can I explain to my own children what am I doing there? Why do I think that free software is important? How can I explain them what software is and why it matters? What the difference between software and hardware is? And that was in 2017. I asked on the mailing list of the FSFE, do you have any recommendations for younger children? And then I got some replies there, and either the suggestions were for older children, so rather from 12 years upwards or so, or I didn't like them so much. So what I did then was I started as good night stories to just invent a few stories, and just every evening I came up with something, and then based on the feedback, I mean, one good thing with children is that they have very direct and good feedback there. I was then further developing this and included some ideas they had and said, oh yeah, but this would also be great. And then, okay, let's include skateboards. And oh yeah, they're now it's summer. We need to include ice cream as well. So I included more and more in this. And then I at one point figured out, well, maybe the direction in which this is going, that might be something that's not just fun and educational for my own children, or a good tool to talk with them about all those topics I care about and where I would also like to see that they are starting their life well prepared for the challenges ahead of them. That I thought maybe it might be good to do a book about that. And at the beginning, I thought maybe self-publish that. And then I was very lucky, because when I talked with a person about that, and he said that I'm thinking about writing a book for children, that he said, well, if you do this, then I will buy 1,000 copies and give that to customers of us. And yeah, as I knew that, then I knew, okay, I will have some funding available. And then the FSFE agreed that I can use some money to get an editor involved, specialized in children's books. And then I started working with the editor on a script. Then from there on, then thought, okay, what do I do about self-publishing, publishing? And I heard a lot of stories about how difficult this is. And somehow I was very lucky because I thought, okay, what would be the best publisher I could imagine for at that time the German book of the story. And then I thought, okay, I'll write to O'Reilly before I do anything else. And 3 hours later, I had a reply, let's have a phone call. And yeah, from there on, then the discussion continued, and they were very interested in this. And lots of things still to discuss, especially also with the Creative Commons licensing, which we choose for the book. But yeah, from there on, it then continued that I then worked with the editor. I found an illustrator for the book, and then also worked with the editors from O'Reilly and further developed that. And yes, then last year in December, we had the German version. And then afterwards, I continued with the English version. And I'm very happy that No Starch Press agreed to publish the book. And yes, now from December on, the book will be available to buy in the US in English as well. So
excellent. And you did a Ukrainian version as well, because I know my son lives in Ukraine, and you sent one of the local charity leaders in his area a big shipment of them. Why did you do a Ukrainian version?
So at the FSFE, we had a discussion when there were so many refugees in Europe from the Ukraine. We thought about, okay, is there anything that we can do? And then we had this idea, maybe when there are lots of children who come, they had to flee, they don't aren't able to take a lot of things with them, it might be a nice idea to hand them a book in their native language so that they have a book again. And there again, we were very lucky that Reinhard Wiesemann was the person who said that, well, that sounds really great. If you do this, I will finance the translation and the printing of the book. And it was also clear at that time that there will probably won't be a commercial publisher for the Ukrainian version for quite a while. So yeah, we then created this translation. We printed 2,750 copies and then distributed that to organizations working with refugees, with some organizations in Ukraine, like your sons. And then send them around that they are then distributed. We also had some readings organized by organizations where there were Ukrainian artists reading the book, and we had discussions with them. So that was the idea there, that we can make a very small contribution there and help them to have a book on their own again in their hands. And
carry on.
Actually, at the moment, in the next days, we will also ship 7,000 books in the same book in Arabic, because after the success with the Ukrainian version, there were also people who said that, well, there are many refugees also who speak Arabic, and if we can't also enable this, and yes, that's why we now also have an Arabic version, which we will distribute in the next days.
I mean, that's all very exciting. You know, I was talking to Doc about this, and we wondered who the characters are. You know, Ada sounds like she might be named after Ada Lovelace, but Doc pointed out that Zangerman sounds like Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and Elon Musk all rolled into one without being any of them. So who would you say were the inspirations for your characters?
I would say that the names you mentioned, plus a few others who are also out there, that's definitely people whom I encountered in my work for Free Software Foundation Europe, and where I then thought, okay, what are some of those characteristics? How can you combine that? And yes, so the funny thing is always I'm asked, a lot of people, they tell me like, oh, it's so clear who it is. And then I ask like, who is it? And then the funny part there is that they mention different people. They mention it's clear that it's Steve Jobs, it's Mark Zuckerberg, it's Elon Musk, it's Thiel, it's whoever. So, yeah, I'm quite happy with that outcome. And the name was also something that was really, really fun, because that was one of the things I struggled really for a long time. And I had for a long time in my script, there was dollar name for Zangerman. And the other names were really they were not good, which I tried. And then one day when I was reading this again, the current script to my children, my older son said, "No, he's called Zangenmann." And I said, "Why? How do you come to this idea?" And he said, I had a dream this night about the book, and there he was called Zangenmann." And I thought, like, wow, that's very good, because it's in German, it fits very well with the Zange, which is like pincer. And so I thought that's really nice. And then in the editing process, we sometimes forgot the N after Zangenmann, and then it was Zangenmann. And then we thought, actually might even be better. And also from the actually, it's not a name. So Zangenmann is something which you find, but Zangenmann is something you don't find anywhere. Very few people. So we thought that's good, so that there is nobody out there who will then be the bad person or someone people associate with something that they don't have anything to do with. So it's so all fictional alert. Characters.
Spoiler alert for the readers. Zangenmann is unredeemed. Do you feel that that's correct? Do you feel that people who insist on lock-in and walled gardens are beyond redemption? Is that the meaning of the end of the book for adults? Or do you feel that there is actually hope in the sequel that you're going to write next?
For me, it was important with the ending of the book that it ends in a way that people think about the topic more. And I didn't want to make the ending of the book to predict too much what is happening and cut too much of the discussion you can have with people who read the book or whom you read the book. So that, I mean, in general, with the other parts of the book as well. So I try to make it in a way that it's very open towards you as the person who discusses this topic with others to think about how you want to discuss issues there and what topics you want to discuss there. That's also why it's quite open what is happening with Zangenmann or why he's acting this way, because I think that's very interesting questions you can talk about. And actually also questions not just to talk about with children, because one of the feedbacks that I received was, I first thought it's a children book, but then people told me, yes, I gave that as a present to my parents, and now finally they understand why I'm doing all this work for free software there. Or they say, well, I gave it as a present to my boss. I think he finally understood why software freedom matters and why we should use more free software in our company. And so it's not just the discussions with children, but also with adults. Oh, and actually, yes, also for politicians. We also gave that as a present to some politicians already. And we a few days ago, there was actually the public reading aloud day in Germany, where people go to schools and they read books there. And two members of the German parliament, they choose the German version of Ada and Zangenmann, went to schools and read it out there. And I think had also quite interesting discussions about monopoly, self-determined use of technology, democracy, and all of that. So, yes.
So I'm wondering, as we're getting short on time now, in the stuff you've said that I've read, something that stands out to me is interesting and I'd like to know more about is, what is the next generation internet that you're talking about? Is it a different protocol completely, or is it just better behavior by the intermediators that are out there? I'm just wondering.
Next generation internet is a... that's a program by the European Commission to support the development of new technologies. So it's in the research and development area that the European Commission wants to encourage new approaches there for new internet technologies. And then there are different programs focusing on different aspects, like networking or like more privacy and other aspects there. So that's the that's a EU-funded projects, and we are consortium partners there together with other organizations to help projects who are applying there and got accepted and with different aspects. So there are people who help with UX design. There are people who help with security. There are then the FSFE is helping them with all kind of legal and licensing questions so that they know, can I combine this free software license with that free software license? How do I make it clear that this is actually free software? So they will bring in reuse.software with those very easy to understand recommendations to make sure that your software is not just out there and available with the source code, but it's actually under free software license so that you can then also exercise the rights to use, study, share, and improve the code.
And that's leading to some great outcomes. You know, that project, Doc was not completely aware about NGI, actually, Matthias.
Yeah,
and
he
was wanting you to comment on what comes next and whether it has Bitcoin in it. And but fortunately, instead of talking about Bitcoin, you talked about NGI. NGI is doing some great work. It's partly funded by EU grants. It's partly funded by a charity called NLNet in the Netherlands. And it's leading. It's what's led to some of the software that is now suddenly becoming popular on the Fediverse and becoming published out there. So very well worth looking into. If you're working on software in Europe at the moment, NGI might well be able to fund your brilliant next idea. So, you know, where do you think software is going in the future in Europe, Matthias? I see a Europe where the old industries and the old ideas of competition have very much got control of both the markets and the strings of power. And I see the work that I'm doing with OSI and the work that you're doing with FSFE as both being crucially important. And yet we haven't really found a rock to put the lever that is going to move the world yet. How hopeful are you that we can prevent the next generation of Europe being the pods in the matrix being harvested for money by big corporations?
I always have some difficulties to predict the future, but in almost all my talks, I'm using a quote which one of my teachers once wrote down for me. It says, many small people in many small places do many small things that will change the face of the world. And that's also my approach there, that, I don't know what will happen. Maybe there are some times where it's worse again for software freedom than it has been in some years. But I mean, what does that change? It's still something that I myself, the FSFE, we will continue to work for software freedom as well as you, the OSI, many other organizations out there are doing. And it's in the end, we also have it in our hands, what will happen there. And it's something where when you think about political decision makers, the organizations working for software freedom, they need to be able to do this work. They need better financial support to do this. They also need other people contributing with their free time, because it's in the end when politicians or decision makers hear something about other topics there, it's the first time they might think, yeah, well, but then when they hear it again and again and again, they will think more about that. And then there will be new, younger advisors to decision makers who grow up where it's way more normal that you have software freedom and this should be something and it's not so abstract anymore and so far away. And so I'm the part which makes me optimistic is that there are people out there who are really dedicated to work on these topics are working for software freedom there. And the other part is also that for the decisions makers, there is also a generational change there. And there are more people getting in roles of influencing decisions who are way more sympathetic and way more positive about free software, who way better understand that free software is something very important for our democracy, that we need to distribute power, that we cannot have just a few companies who control what we can and what we cannot do with technology, but that we need to distribute that, and that we need to have a digital sovereignty of governments. And so those are things which are also pushed more and more. While, of course, there are those topics popping up where you think like, wow, it feels like we now did two steps forward and now it's the four steps back again. And then the important thing is, from my perspective, not to stop, but try to make eight steps in front again.
That's very optimistic, and I'm really happy with this. We're about out of time, so we always close with two questions. You've covered the other questions I think we already would have had. One is, what is your favorite text editor and scripting language?
So, yes, I am using the editor of the Beast. So, and that's something where I spend most of my time in. So it's VI or Vim, the text editor, and scripting language. I did some Bash. I did a little bit of Python, but I'm not so often programming myself. So there are great tools out there. But I love Python and I love Bash.
Well, that's great. So thank you so much for being on the show. I want everybody to go buy the book, get the T-shirts, look at what the FSFE is doing. I really love everything that you're doing. I'm very encouraged by it. So thanks so much for being on the show. We'll have to have you back again to talk progress.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Simon, that was good. And thanks for carrying the weight on that one. I had to be riding mute. Now it's quiet in the background. I had trucks going by. I had a guy under the window hosing out buckets with a power hose.
So. It's always the way, isn't it? Yeah. Well, I knew you. I thought you would love that because you know, to start with, you know, you're an author and you appreciate a well targeted book, and I think that Matthias's book is well targeted, and he's obviously hit a nerve with it because it's being picked up in Germany and elsewhere, and you know, I will put in the show notes where people can get it from. They can get it from No Starch Press in the US, and there's a discount code available for you to get it. And I'm hoping it's going to be shipped in time for the holidays. But also the wider organization, you know, I work with FSFE quite a lot in doing European policy work. They have some great staff. They're always very positive and friendly. They've had some big challenges to deal with over the last decade. So, you know, I think you've got a great story there, and I think it will be well worth getting Matthias back. Also, some of his colleagues, like Alexander Sander, who does their policy work, would have some fascinating things to say about what's going on with technology policy in Europe and its relationship with software freedom.
Yeah, I'm very encouraged. And I have to admit, I did not know that much about the FSFE. I mean, I knew it existed. I didn't know much more. I've sort of despaired where we are in the U.S. sort of in general anyway, where we don't talk politics here, but basically we just have an extreme right and extreme left, and the rest of it is all just noise. And it seems like there's really constructive stuff going on in Europe in general, and they're part of it. And it's a model for the world. Anyway. Just I'm just digging it, and I want to know more.
Yeah, they've got some really cute merchandise as well, I have to say. So my favorite thing they've got is they have a children's sized T-shirt that says on it, "I am a fork," that every kid on the planet ought to go buy.
I love that.
Kids. Yeah.
So they
have a baby bib, and they have a T-shirt that says it, which I think is great.
I also love that that his kid named Zangaman. I think that's excellent. It's also funny. Oh no, I blame the kid. You know, the kid came up with it. So next week we have Jason Griffey on, and my notes here say Doc in Hawaii. I'm not in Hawaii next week. I will be back on the mainland with a better connection with Ethernet, with windows closed in my office. That is the plan. So so enthused about that. And Tim Pozar the week after that, and others, other great ones coming up as well. So any plugs? We've already plugged the FSFE pretty well.
And yeah.
The OSI, or
you know, we've got to help their fundraising at this time of year. You know, the only thing I'd note is apparently something happened at Twitter recently. I don't quite know what, and suddenly my account on the Fediverse, which, and you should say Fediverse rather than Mastodon, because there's lots of different apps on the, in the
right. Fediverse. Yes.
Suddenly my account has gone absolutely crazy, and I've got loads of activity there, and I'd encourage anyone who's listening to go look for me on the Fediverse. You'll find me on mesh.cloud/webmink, I'd love to see you over there. And there's lots and lots of very well-tempered, very eloquent, very enjoyable conversations going on that really could not happen on Twitter anymore. There's too much sniping on Twitter for that to happen. So do come join us on Mastodon or on the Fediverse, and I look forward to seeing you there.
That's a good distinction. And I just have a note out there for everybody who's doing a story on Mastodon, and this is still with full respect for the Fediverse. A mastodon and a woolly mammoth are not the same. Show a picture of a mastodon, okay? Not a woolly mammoth. They all show a woolly mammoth. I don't know why. They're more interesting looking, probably, and they have fancier tusks, or they had. And there are more of them frozen in the tundra that are thawing out as global warming progresses. But mastodons are different. So show the right thing. Anyway. So that's a kind of, yeah, there we go. Oh, there's a woolly, yeah, mastodons, different. So, Wikipedia has a good picture of both of them together that should make clear what the difference was, because they're both gone. Anyway, so thanks a lot, Simon. This has been a great show. And again, we'll see everybody next week for Jason Griffey. That'll be a good one. Take it easy, everybody.
Hey folks, I'm Ant Pruitt, and what do you get your favorite tech geek that has everything? A Club Twit gift subscription, of course. Twit podcasts keep them informed and entertained with the most relevant tech news podcasts available. With the Club Twit subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes, and special content such as AMAs, which I just love hosting. Plus, exclusive shows such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Purchase your geek's gift at twit.tv/clubtwit, and it will thank you every day.